Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast. NFL Week 3 Monday Night Football Edition. And a jam-packed show for you, like always. Break down the game between the Redskins and Bears later this evening. We'll have some injury updates with Dr. Chow and some of those marquee names in the National Football League that'll be out for how long remains to be seen. And, of course, recapping the good, the bad, and the ugly for what we saw. Before we get into all that, I am your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, a man who needs no introduction, the one, the only Payne Insider.
Monday morning, week three.
The grind is real, my friend. The grind is real.
Yes, this is quite the grind. Three shows a week.
So, well, hey, I mean, you know, eventually when this thing expands, I mean, I know you're going to look forward to like 3 hours and we treat it like a morning radio show, right? That's what you're really itching for?
Yeah. See how that goes.
Busy weekend in the National Football League. Always curious to get your thoughts, Payne, as we get right out. And I feel like it's a logical place to start with what we saw unfold on Sunday Night Football. I know the national narrative is one thing. We do things very differently around here. But more importantly, we got off to the sluggish start we expected from those two teams. You got to love a field goal fest in the first half.
Nothing wrong with a slow start. Nothing wrong with that at all. What we expected, the national narrative is what? Freddie Kitchens stinks this morning and...
How could you run a draw on 4th and 9? I mean, I'm listening to Rex Ryan go bonkers. I'm going, Rex, there's a reason you're on TV and there's a reason Freddie's calling plays for the Cleveland Browns. Let's pump the brakes a little here, big fella.
Now, it's looked a little different than last year. Without question, I think Freddie even admitted that a little bit. The offensive line's a train wreck. You don't have Njoku out there, so you can't run a lot of two tight end sets at this point to help in protection. The route trees are... of the Bruce Arians mindset, no risk it, no biscuit. So that needs to change a little bit. Obviously, I think you probably prefer a run down around the goal line there with multiple timeouts at your disposal late in that game. The 4th and 9, I'm not as tough on him for that call. I do like the idea of going for it. The trying to deceive everyone. It worked, except wily old veteran Eric Weddle. He sniffed that thing out immediately. But if Chubb's able to make Weddle miss, it's a long run. But we kind of mentioned this, right? Freddie Kitchens was awesome last year. That was as an OC. I don't think there was anyone on the Freddie Kitchens bandwagon quicker than us. But with the AFC podcast preview, we dialed back expectations, said, listen, this is quite the hike, right? From tight end coach to head coach in less than a year. He's having trouble right now, kind of controlling everything around him. If you kind of just stick him in a box and say, hey, design some offense, call some plays, I think he's fine. It's everything else that he's dealing with right now, and he seems to be a little bit overwhelmed. It'll be interesting to see the adjustments he makes, but again, when you go out and get an OBJ and you already have Landry and Higgins has kind of taken that next step as a really nice third option, it's tough to get out of 11 personnel, especially when you have that aforementioned injury with Njoku. You just don't have the tight ends on the roster to play a lot of 12. So it'll be interesting to see how they make that shift. It's got to be with the route concepts, shortening those up a little bit to give Baker some easy throws and obviously not sit in the pocket forever, but it's also on Baker a little bit. You watch some of the All-22, he's holding onto the ball too long, trying to create these long dynamic plays when there's guys open underneath. So it's a culmination of a lot of things happening on offense that hasn't made it as successful as it was with Freddie towards the end of last season.
And we have seen the market react a little bit to the Browns' early season struggles. We'll get to that when we break down some of the look-ahead lines and see how market perception and power ratings have changed in the eyes of odds makers. But like we do every morning, at least as far as Mondays are concerned, Payne, we look back at the weekend that was.
I was going to say, you don't do this on like Tuesdays, maybe?
We can if you want. Hey, if you can, if we want. I mean, I'm more than happy to send you sound bites if you want to listen to me droning on about what I saw and I went back and watched some of the games to try and dissect a little bit. But because we are the happy-go-lucky people and people come to us as a bastion of light and hope after NFL weekends, I want to start with what actually impressed you over the weekend in a positive fashion.
Well, let's start with the obvious. This is the obvious one, and I Mason felt
Rudolph?
Pretty good about it.
Are you going to start Mason Rudolph?
Mason did enough to get us to the window.
That's
it was ugly.
That's a good point.
The other guy that got us to the window was Daniel Jones. And this isn't surprising to me, because if you remember, I was my crotchety self when we were breaking down the Giants with the preview podcast. It's like, I don't even want to talk about the offense if Eli Manning's the quarterback. This gave us a glimmer of hope. Obviously, you know, you're on the road. It's your first start. You're trailing by 18, and your most dynamic offensive weapon in Saquon Barkley's out for the second half. So to me, it's impressive. You look what Jones did. Pat Shurmur didn't coddle the guy. Only two of his 36 attempts were behind the line of scrimmage. You look even further. Daniel Jones completed 8 of his 13 attempts that traveled 11 or more yards in the air. Two of them went for touchdowns. You look at the average completed air yards. Daniel Jones averaged the 9th most at 8 yards. So really aggressive, but at the same time, really accurate. Completion percentage against the Bucs defense, that was 4th in overall defensive efficiency coming in, was 3.5% better than expectation. So for me, great game from Daniel Jones, obviously, not just on the scoreboard, but within the box score, within the metrics. And you look, just he didn't have benefit from a good ground game either. Barkley and Gallman, 23 yards on 13 rushes. So this was literally Daniel Jones, Shepard, Ingram, and a mash unit basically everywhere else.
Jones finished the game as the Giants' leading rusher. 4 carries, 28 yards, 2 touchdowns. We saw him call his own number on the go-ahead touchdown late and just look like a guy that showed a ton of poise in situations where he very easily could have crumbled. I mean, you mentioned it, down 18 points to lead this team back. And the one thing for me, Payne, and I know it's always hard to quantify and it sounds ridiculous because you get lost in narrative, did it feel like the defense played with more life and there was actually a sense of confidence that Jones had this rallying factor? Whereas the body language with Eli, hey, they get down 7 points, everybody slumps, and just things continue to snowball, or is that just me?
No, that's usually what you see with an injection of a quarterback into the lineup, right? Everyone else has got to step up around him. The young guys like Sterling Shepard and Ingram kind of know at this point Daniel Jones is going to be their quarterback of the future, so you get a little extra pep in your step there. Everyone else does just a little bit more. And then obviously this number, well, it'll sound like Monday morning quarterback, but I don't think the Bucs are in a position to be laying 7 to anybody at this stage. I mean, I know I love Arians. They're going to be improved, but that was just a really, really tall number, especially when you looked at a lot of the metrics for the Giants. And I know people think Eli got a raw deal. I'm of the mindset he didn't get a raw deal overall, but certainly if this was going to be a move you were making after 2 weeks, I would have told him before the season and figured that situation out. But the offensive line wasn't specifically good against the Bucs, but they'd been pretty good throughout the first 2 games. That was something I heard a lot of people talk about. This Giants offensive line isn't any good. Wasn't great here in the Bucs game, but it was fantastic the first 2 weeks of the season. So if that performance can be what it looks like moving forward consistently, it's really going to help Daniel Jones.
Yeah, lost in all that, Shaq Barrett continues to be a force for the Bucs defensively. We'll get to Bruce Arians and the way he handled the late game situation, I'm sure, in just a matter of minutes. One quarterback performance, Payne, that stuck out for me was the battle of former teammates. Kyle Allen out-dueling Kyler Murray, 19 of 26, 4 touchdowns, 261 yards, obviously aided by 188 total yards from Christian McCaffrey. But does Carolina wait till Cam? Do they basically tell Cam, hey, take your time and get healthy and trust that Kyle Allen can replicate this? Or was this more a byproduct, in your opinion, of an Arizona defense that isn't that good?
Yeah, probably a little of both, right? And Kyle Allen got help from McCaffrey, as you kind of alluded to. He was only asked to throw it 26 times. But again, you look at some of those numbers, 8 of the 26 attempts were 5 yards and in. So it wasn't like he was coddled or anything like that. He did only attempt 1 explosive pass. It kind of goes to show you what Vance was doing there with his secondary. There is a lot of off coverage, allowed Allen to hit some, you know, these short intermediate throws. But I think Kyle Allen was very good. His average completed air yards, 7th most this week. accuracy was off the charts. The completion percentage was 9% better than expectation. I think the important thing here is, you know, we saw Carolina at +3, even at +2.5. There was some sharp money on that side. Okay. And I think when you're trying to assess the value of quarterbacks and the possible downgrade from the starter to the backup, it's important to really think about who the starting quarterback is and their production level current form. Okay. Current form, I think, is really important, because if you're basing Cam's value off, you know, this idea that he's the 2016 Super Bowl quarterback who made that run, you probably bet Arizona here. If you gauged Cam as the guy whose offensive coordinator, right, doesn't allow him to run on multiple short yardage situations, the guy that has 5 carries for 0 yards this season, your drop off to Kyle Allen wasn't much, right? Because Kyle Allen doesn't have that attribute of the legs, but I think he's probably a better passer. And right now, Cam doesn't have that attribute of the legs. So the drop off wasn't that severe here.
No, it makes a ton of sense. And I think a lot of people get lost in name recognition instead of paying attention to the productivity and what you're seeing. If a guy's operating at about 60% capacity, you're not going to make a full adjustment. We talked about this number a little bit and how it moved 5 points, at least to the naked eye. But when you're not going through key numbers, it's not a huge leap of faith for books to take you from a 2.5-point underdog to a 2.5-point favorite. Doesn't change the win probability that much. As far as other good performances, Payne, what else stood out to you over the weekend?
Jacoby Brissett, very efficient in a game again, right? And he did it the entire second half without T.Y. Hilton. Now, again, like, Brissett isn't asked to, like, execute the impossible here. Frank Reich, very QB-friendly scheme, QB-friendly game plan. So, again, just, you know, you look, one explosive attempt. 5 of Brissett's 28 attempts traveled more than 10 yards in the air. So it is this controlled environment for him, so to speak, but he was accurate. Completion percentage was 4% above expectation. So I thought Jacoby Brissett was good again, despite the little steam there on the screen for Atlanta. I didn't think that was going to be the final say, but the one thing to monitor here, though, is the T.Y. Hilton injury. I know we'll ask Dr. Chow. That is important, I think, because you know the Colts are going to throw a lot of short stuff, but you have to back off a little bit with guys like Paris Campbell and T.Y. Hilton, who can take the lid off of defense. All of a sudden, if T.Y. Hilton's out for an extended stretch, defenses can now squat on the short stuff a little bit more. So that's going to be important to monitor there a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who watched that game the second half, the Colts ran a grand total of 3 offensive plays in the third quarter. It looked by all accounts the Falcons were going to mount a comeback, and I know we were texting a little bit going through. That was one hell of a drive the Colts put together when they needed it most. Went out there, got themselves some separation, and were able to get a big, big home win holding on there late in the contest. With the good pain, there also comes the bad, and I think there are a couple different directions we can go. Not sure how we want to differentiate between bad and ugly. But I think we can go back to Thursday night for me, at least as far as the Titans and their pass protection. I know we talk a little bit about, hey, some of the onus falls on the O-line. Some of it falls on the quarterback. Marcus Mariota brought to the turf 9 times in Jacksonville in that ugly offensive effort against the Jaguars.
Yeah, it's not all on the Tennessee offensive line. You know, obviously you're without Taylor Lewan. I mentioned on the AFC Preview podcast about Jack Conklin. You know, he's been dealing with injuries all offseason. And through 3 games, he hasn't been his normal dominant self, right? But Mariota's been horrific. He was the cause, I'm looking at these numbers now, of nearly 20% of the pressures allowed through 3 games. He's ran himself into 25% of the sacks allowed by the Titans through 3 games. So you look at Mariota's completion percentage, well below expectation. Arthur Smith, the new OC, hasn't been very good past the Cleveland opener. Right. And I think this is probably, you know, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, but it's important to note these guys are humans, right? So like guys like Arthur Smith or Zach Taylor, and I think the list goes on with the number of first time head coaches and coordinators we have in the league this year. It's the biggest job of these guys' lives so far. So like game one for Arthur Smith or Zach Taylor, they're prepared to the fullest extent, right? They've had all offseason to kind of, you know, make that first showing look electric. Right. It's like that time you get your best job, you land your best job the first day, like you're ready to go. These guys had months to script those opening drives, multiple drives even. Right. Opposing defenses don't have the benefit of seeing or knowing what you're going to do because the film is limited. Then what happens after the first game? Your stuff's on film. Your prep time shrinks from, you know, an entire offseason to 5 or 6 days. Things go awry. And I don't know why, but I'm kind of thinking of this now. It's like that episode of Seinfeld, Todd, where George can't go left. He's like, he's unable to score because of the situation where the girl's positioned on the couch. He's a right-hander, can't go left. It's basically what Arthur Smith's offense looks like the last 2 weeks. Like, now that they kind of figured out what he wants to do, he doesn't have a backup plan. And it's been really ugly for the last 2 weeks.
Ugly may be a bit of an understatement, and the Titans will have their hands full as they go out on the road, albeit with extra time to prepare to take on the Falcons this coming Sunday. What else disappointed you from your full day of watching football?
You know, we've hyped them up a little bit, and for good reason, but I think it's only fair if we talk about Lamar Jackson as probably bad for week three. Certainly bettors are happy with him, with those the late heroics there, but you look, Baltimore trailed by 17 on two different occasions. You look at his completion percentage, it was 10% below expectation despite, you know, facing a Chiefs secondary that's probably below average, not only in the sum of its parts, but metrically through the first 2 weeks as well. KC was allowing 49% of passes to grade successful. So not very good for Lamar passing the ball. He had the largest discrepancy of any quarterback in the NFL this week in terms of average intended air yards per pass versus average air yards per completion. So again, I think he's obviously far better than the national media thinks he is, but wasn't very good in week three. And I think I still have this in the back of my mind that says, hey, don't forget the fact that in the 11 games that Lamar started in the NFL, he's only faced three defenses that ranked above league average in defensive efficiency over those 11 starts. So something to continue to monitor as the season moves on here.
Definitely was interesting. You watched the performance, and then I don't want to call it bad or ugly or anything by any of that stretch. I know John Harbaugh drew a ton of criticism, electing to go for two a number of times, taking that aggro-aggressive approach, going for it on fourth down. Not sure, because we obviously didn't chat in great detail before jumping on here. Do you have a chance to watch that game? I'm always curious to get your take in terms of John Harbaugh's approach, basically saying, hey, look, we know we have to go out there and score play for play with the Chiefs, but do you think he made the right decisions in a lot of situations?
Early on, I prefer kicking the PAT, but my understanding coming into the game was they were going to be super aggressive. And obviously, when you have a Chiefs defense, who, again, was a little bit better against the run the first 2 weeks than they were last season, you do have Lamar. You do have a situation where you need 2 yards. He's electric with his feet. The other aspect here was the weather was predictably about to roll in at 3 o'clock. So there was this long discussion of let's try to get as many points on the board before the weather gets ugly here at 3 o'clock. So that was part of the decision-making process. But again, once you miss that opening two, you start playing chase a little bit. I don't mind the aggressive approach ever, right? I think I'm probably the only guy that was praising Frank Reich last year for not wanting a push in overtime and going for it on like 4th and 6 in his own end during overtime. So I'm okay with being aggressive. There just needs to be a little bit better execution. But again, that opening, yeah, kick the point after there so you don't have to chase the rest of the way. But again, the mindset going into the game we knew was going to be of aggression when you face a Kansas City Chiefs offense that's electric. And you know your secondary has some question marks. And then again, that added element of the weather rolling in at 3 o'clock really forced Harbaugh to want to be aggressive here.
Last thing, when we look at ugly performances over the weekend, I never want to be too critical on a quarterback making his first start, and I don't think he deserves a lion's share of the blame. But you watch that Steelers 49ers game, as you mentioned, the Steelers able to get us to the window as 7-point underdogs on the bye, 6.5, kind of the consensus. This is a team that averaged shade under 5 yards per play, 4.7, and it's a late James Conner fumble. You can't lose football games. I don't care where they're played, at home, on the road, or on the goddamn moon. When you finish +3 in the turnover department, you force, what, 4 of them in the first half and go into the break up 6-3.
Yeah, the right team won that game. The team that was more deserving won that game, and certainly a positive for my Dolphins as the Steelers continue to rack up losses. And that's going to be a tough one to overcome, right? Because the whole sales pitch this week was we went out and got Minkah Fitzpatrick. We traded away our first round pick for him. We have faith in Mason Rudolph. And that was the rallying cry. That was the rallying point all week. And so when you come away with a loss, and honestly, you look at the yards per play metrics, you look at how that game unfolded, San Francisco probably should have covered that game with ease. So now you're back home Monday night against Cincinnati. It'll be interesting to see what this vibe looks like for the Steelers. Now, to Mason's credit, hit a couple explosive passes. His aggressiveness rating was the highest of any quarterback this week in week three. So he certainly got the confidence. He just needs to be a little bit more accurate, needs to be a little bit better decision maker. The interception there on the opening drive of the third quarter was horrific. Not sure what he saw there. But he looks somewhat competent. Now let's see what it looks like. Now teams have film on him a little bit here. He does have the extended rest there with Monday night, so hopefully they implement a little bit more into the game plan for him this week. So it'll be interesting to see and monitor. I think he's capable. He's obviously not Big Ben in his prime, but let's see what it looks like against Cincinnati.
One last thing, and then we'll head on to some of the look-ahead lines that were out there. Wanted to get your take, Payne, on the Green Bay Packers. It feels for the second time in as many weeks, the offense started like a house on fire. Aaron Rodgers with the aggressive play call to Marquez Valdes-Scantling gets him off to a 7-0 lead. But yet again, the Green Bay offense, after the initial script wears off, and whether you want to call it 15 or 30 plays, however Matt LaFleur structures it, seem to tail off. And there's some real concerns, at least for me, when I watch the Packers, that this team either can't make adjustments or there's something going on. And you look at an offense over the second, third, and fourth quarters right now ranking 30th in the National Football League.
Yeah. You know, a lot of smoke and mirrors so far, but you are 3-0 with a new head coach, a new system, a new scheme. So you're in a great spot, right? It's winning while you're learning, hopefully. And come the middle of the season, you've got enough wins and you start to progress a little bit. The opening touchdown there was just Aaron Rodgers being heroic, right? Being smart, seeing the guy jump off sides like he does so many times and just air it out. And Valdes-Scantling just beats his man. First quarter, Green Bay averaged 9 yards per play. It did tick down throughout the rest of the three quarters. But in saying that, they averaged 1.8 yards more per play than Denver did. Passing wise, Green Bay averaged 8.1 yards per pass for the game. Denver just 4.6. So it was certainly a game they deserved to win. It was a game where they cover the number despite some sharp money on Denver. So to me, they obviously exceeded Vegas expectation, and I think my expectation as well, knowing who was on the Broncos.
Well, the reason I mention the Packers is because we'll have an in-depth preview of the Packers next game on a short week when they play host to the much maligned and banged up Philadelphia Eagles. And Payne, when you look at some of the look-ahead numbers here, those numbers had the Packers listed as a 2.5-point favorite. Lo and behold, you wake up this morning, and I know that number didn't include the cluster injuries Philadelphia is dealing with. The Packers all the way out to a 5-point favorite.
Moved a little more than this morning, yeah?
Yeah, it's ticked up a shade from 4.5 out to the dead zone at 5.
Okay, so, you know, obviously massive game for the Eagles. 1-3 would certainly be a surprise. Have to monitor the situation, obviously, on that cluster injury to the receiver core. So both Elshon and DeSean Jackson, you're going to just have to keep a close eye on that. Wentz, it's clear he's missed those two guys, right? He missed them again this past Sunday. The metrics look okay. Completion percentage, not good at all, right? 13% below expectation, only better than Josh Rosen for week three. But again, Green Bay 3-0, despite having a ton of issues. If you can negate that opening script from LaFleur and Rodgers, it seems like you're going to have a pretty good chance here. But we'll see what we get from Philadelphia's defense. The line's beaten and battered a little bit. We know about some of the injuries up front. Cox is also playing through some injuries, so interesting the line. Let's see where it goes. One that we'll obviously talk about in really, really large detail because it's a Thursday night game.
And of course, as I say, that number now painted 4.5, trending towards 4. But plenty of 72 hours to digest where that number will go and what's going to happen with it. We talked a little bit about the Browns and what that particular number means. I know this price isn't widely available, but you on a look-ahead number, you had the Ravens about a 3.5-point favorite. That number, most locations, out to 5.5, a secondary key number. It blows through, obviously, being the 4.
Yeah, you kind of alluded to at the top, nothing but doom and gloom this morning on social media and TV in regards to the Browns. Listen, this game, I think, is pretty simple. It comes down to how well the Browns O-line protects Baker in the way that Freddie Kitchens calls his offense. You know, last season, it just It was different when Freddie was only the OC and play caller. It looked different. It felt different. It was more efficient. Even Freddie admitted that it's looked a lot different and it is a little different this season in his postgame presser. We just need to see, as I kind of mentioned, more quick passes, more formations with running backs and tight ends helping protect and chip. And again, it is tougher to do with Njoku out. It kind of hinders Freddie's ability to get away from that 11 personnel. Route combinations, again, need to shorten a little bit. But we've seen Kyler and obviously Mahomes torch the Baltimore secondary the last 2 weeks without Jimmy Smith and Young. So there's going to be some opportunity there. We'll also have to monitor the injuries in the Browns secondary because they were playing with four new guys for Sunday Night Football.
Nothing wrong getting to the window with a first half under ticket when you have a bunch of guys getting called up, getting serious burn in the Browns secondary for the first time.
Well, it was the strategicness of what was taking place there offensively for Cleveland. It was going to be more controlled. It was going to be a lot more running. That was what they were talking about all week, going slower pace-wise to protect that secondary.
And it worked like a charm, getting Nick Chubb involved, who had a pretty productive day. Chiefs on the road at the, hard for me to say, undefeated Detroit Lions. Look ahead number here, 4.5. This number trending towards a full touchdown.
Having a really hard time. Hard time in general this morning.
It appears as such. I'm worried about you over there.
I don't know what the Lions are right now. Right? You blow a game that you should win against Arizona. You pick up a win against the Chargers you don't really deserve. Make a ton of timely plays, I think, to pull the upset against Philadelphia. Matchup-wise, you think Kerryon probably has some success here. Obviously, a road out-of-conference game for the Chiefs. The look-ahead line, though, is a little short. My core number says the sharper shops are spot on at 6.5. So, first thing Monday morning, I haven't dug into this game totally yet, matchup-wise, information-wise, injury-wise, yet to see if there's going to be value. But just with the core number, I thought 6.5 was pretty good.
Look ahead number had Seattle, about a 3-point favor. You did have to lay a little bit of juice with them on the road against Arizona. We see the Cardinals drop a 38-20 decision to Carolina. Seattle pretty much dominated as far as the box score is concerned against the Saints, despite not getting any momentum plays. And this number up a full point out to 4.
Yeah, bottom line, I think Brian Schottenheimer needs to figure out how to get his offensive script to be a little bit better, because Seattle has not gotten out to fast starts at all. And, you know, you look through 3 weeks, 7 first quarter points. That's it. But I think the market has gotten a little bit more sophisticated, obviously, over the years. So you see Seattle loses, but they outgain New Orleans by 250 yards. They give up a special teams touchdown, a defensive touchdown. And so that's partly why we're seeing this number balloon out a little bit. Big game for Arizona here. But I want to see what the offense looks like, because I was really happy with what they did at Baltimore. Kingsbury just, you know, a lot more motion, a lot of more, you know, pre-snap stuff to fool the defense. I didn't see all that again at home against Carolina, which was really, really odd. So for whatever reason, and I think this is the big misconception, right? When we get these offensive gurus involved, right? Air quotes there. That we just assume that, you know, going 4 wide and chucking the ball deep is this elaborate offense, that it's this greatly schemed offense. It's not now in 2019. It's really easy to defend like 3 and 4 wide if you're not overly sophisticated in what you're doing. So I was again a little disappointed seeing Kingsbury with the pre-snap motion, how he was getting guys the ball against Carolina. It was fantastic against Baltimore. Hopefully that's the offense we see against Seattle, because I think it'll be needed here.
And last but not least, Sunday Night Football sees the Cowboys on the road. A number, as you mentioned, the Saints win the game, but they get outstated in pretty much every single category. You see the Cowboys go from a 2.5-point road favorite out to a full field goal.
Yeah, and where it reopened at some of the sharper shops was 3.5. And all the hooks are starting to disappear a little bit, which is interesting. Obviously, New Orleans, I think, has revenge from last season from that Thursday night game. But our listeners know by now, I am significantly higher on Dallas than just about anybody. I'm not as high on Teddy Bridgewater. The win in Seattle kind of felt like this all-in effort, right? You're staying on the West Coast. You're doing lots of like team building and bonding. You listen to the players after the press conference, right? And it's just like, it was a sense of relief. my core makes this game 3. I just wonder if come Sunday night, books are going to be forced to adjust this number a tick higher because, you know, you have 3-0 America's team going up against a backup quarterback. I know the environment will be rocking, but books are going to have an interesting time navigating that key number, I think, Sunday night.
Well, we saw it, and something that we haven't really seen in the past happened last night during Sunday Night Football. I know we have Dr. Chow waiting in the wings, which will help contextualize some of the look-ahead lines and where these numbers will go. But, Payne, I can't really remember a primetime game where you saw a point spread blow through a key number like the Rams did last night from 3 and not have any resistance. Some of the more recreational shops out here in the desert ultimately closed 4.5 on that contest. I don't know if we'll see a similar scenario with the Cowboys and Saints, but at least it showed the book's willingness to be somewhat aggressive.
Yeah, so early on in the week, there was some sharp money on the Rams below the 3. Once we got to like 3, 3.5, it was tough to get the public off that side, and we did see it go to 4.5. There was, again, a touch of resistance at 4.5. A couple of shops went back to 4, but you're right. It ultimately closed, you know, 4.5, 5. I don't know why. 5 isn't really a key number, but you heard a couple of the odds makers that are on social media say, took a bet at 5. We came back off it. This will be a similar situation, I would have to think, where we see the public on one side and they're dying for Teddy Bridgewater money. Come Sunday night.
It'll, of course, be a game we talk about in greater detail on the Thursday podcast, but plenty of things to do before we get there, including figuring out the injury impact to some major marquee stars.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, there's only one man to turn to.
If you're hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with 17-year NFL team doctor turned medical analyst, Dr. David Chow.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
This is Chow's Corner.
When it comes to injury information, there's only one place we like to go on Monday morning, and you can follow Dr. David Chow on Twitter at Pro Football Talk. Extensive experience and one of the best game day follows for real-time information updates. And Dr. Chow, normally we start with players, but I got to ask, were you surprised Pete Carroll was able to give it a go on the sidelines for the Seattle Seahawks yesterday?
He's toughing it out there. Although, you know, obviously that's got to hurt there, you know, ball off the nose. I think most people saw the videotape and he couldn't get stitches even. It had to be taped because I'm sure it was a very jagged and stellate type explosion type injury. And you could see it was still bleeding during the game. But I'm going to date myself there as I kept thinking Marsha Brady when I was looking at that.
Hey, Payne tells me all the time, you know, when I don't get up in the morning and I'm ready to podcast and I have a soft tissue injury, he tells me to rub some dirt on it. So it's good to see Pete out there, a little butterfly, get things going. Although watching that performance, he might have been happier had he decided to actually get stitched up and stay in the hospital. But all joking aside, one of the biggest names in the National Football League, not only for his impact on the field, but also fantasy purposes, Saquon Barkley. Ankle injury, was seen in a walking boot on crutches. The initial report is a high ankle sprain. I wasn't sure if you saw it any differently. And what does that mean to the prognosis and when the Giants can expect to have him back on the football field?
It is absolutely a high ankle sprain. And at the new website, I actually had video describing how it was in game and actually called it a high ankle sprain before he came back out on the sideline with the crutches and a boot. And he's going to miss several weeks as a result of this. MRI is going to show a sprain of the syndesmotic ligament. I don't think it's going to need surgery, but at least it's a moderate variety high ankle sprain, which I think is worse than the one he had as a freshman at Penn State where he missed 2 games. He's not returning in September, obviously. He's going to, let's hope for a late October return. Maybe October 20th might be the target for him on the good side. It might leak a little longer given his position too. I mean, look at Nick Bosa. He struggled to come back too early from a high ankle sprain, different position. And obviously AJ Green's 8 weeks so far, but I don't think it's as bad as AJ Green.
Positive news there for Giants fans. And I want to ask you one more question about another dynamic offensive weapon with the Indianapolis Colts, and that's T.Y. Hilton. Didn't return in the second half with a quad injury. It's one he's been battling with. If you listen to him in the post game, he said he knew he tweaked it and he wouldn't be back for the second half, so he wanted to finish that last drive in the first half to get 7. They did that. But what does it look like long-term for T.Y. Hilton and the quad injury?
Yeah, you got to hand it to T.Y. Hilton. And you, as you guys know, he's played through a lot of injuries, including last year, all this ankle stuff, not practiced all week and still performed. And similar here, this time it's a quad, hopefully quad muscle. That's where the wrap and the ice was. And after his touchdown catch right before the end of the first half, you saw him. He never went back to the bench. He just signaled to the sideline like, hey, I'm headed to the locker room right now. And you knew kind of he was done. At this point in time, I think with the muscle injury, the fact that he knew he had to get pulled the second half of the game, next week is pretty iffy here. It could be a week or two, even though he always seems to exceed estimates in terms of return and come back earlier. I think they don't want to turn this into a long-term thing. So he might be down for a week or two, but we'll have to look at the reports going forward. No surgery, season not done. He has great ability to play through, but this one might cost him a little bit of time.
Another receiver I want to ask you about is Julian Edelman. There were some conflicting reports. Some people thought it was a chest. It looks to be a rib cartilage injury there. Another MRI today here in a little bit. What does it look like for Julian Edelman? And obviously we know that's a position that's a little bit more valuable now with Antonio Brown gone.
Oh, absolutely. And Julian Edelman all along to me, it looked like a rib injury. And we talked about the medical term is costochondral cartilage, rib cartilage, or soft cartilage of the rib injury. That's why the x-rays were negative. Yes, the Patriots reported it as a chest injury, which is proper. It's chest wall. It's not improper. But when it was reported as chest and he didn't come out on the sideline for the second half, I think there was a lot of angst that maybe there was internal organ damage or otherwise. I never thought so, and it seems right now that there isn't any report of that, and it makes sense now there's an MRI or something coming to look at the rib cartilage. Bear in mind, rib cartilage injuries are more painful than rib fractures. I know that sounds funny, but that is true. But there's still ways to block it, still ways to get them to go. My best expectation on Julian Edelman is that he's going to not practice this week, but he's still going to be available for the game this weekend.
Interesting news there. That'd be good. He is a tough guy. We know that. Last one I want to ask you about, it's on the defensive side of the ball. Keanu Neal, another injury to Dan Quinn's defense. Looks like an Achilles injury. Preliminary reports are it's torn. What do we make of that injury? And was it compensation or was there a connection to the ACL possibly?
Well, you know, such bad luck for him, and everyone has to feel for the guy, you know, the tears. He knew it immediately. And yes, as a player, you can know that it's bad because when you tear your Achilles, all of a sudden you can't push off. You can't even, quote, step on the gas pedal, so to speak, push your foot down, and you know that it's torn. And I think that's the emotion that he was feeling. He tore his ACL in the first game last season, and now another early season injury. Yes, Todd, and pain, same side, the Achilles, the same side as the ACL, the dreaded A's, and he's got both of them on the same side. Is there scientific absolute proof that they're linked? No, but there certainly is a tendency for compensation in these injuries, no different than let's say, last year, Dalvin Cook with the same side hamstring after his ACL, or Ronald Darby this year with the same side hamstring after coming off his ACL. And I think there is some compensatory mechanism there, so that's too bad for Keanu Neal.
Always tough when you see an impactful player not lose not one season, but two seasons, especially if there is anything connecting all of that. One of the big terms, Dr. Cha, that we use on this podcast that Payne's great about educating our listenership is with cluster injuries. And there was no greater illustration than a team that dealt with that this past weekend. Then the Philadelphia Eagles, who saw themselves go from a touchdown favorite down to a 4-point favorite before losing outright to the Detroit Lions. Quick turnaround for the Eagles on the road against the Packers. We know they missed a number of contributors, both on the offensive and defensive side. What does the prognosis look like in your eyes for the potential to get any of those players back in the fold on a short week?
Well, we've talked all season about how the DBs are short on the Eagles, and they started the season that way. And now Ronald Darby, as we mentioned, is out with a hamstring. He's going to miss some time off the same with coming off the ACL as well. Their linebacker is still out. They're down a couple guys in the D-line. And even last night, in addition to the Jeffries and DeSean Jackson being down and Goddard not being able to contribute anything, their backup left tackle went down. Andre Dillard, what looks like a multi-week MCL sprain to his knee. And Jason Peters was ill. So the really only good news for Thursday is you can hope Jason Peters can get over his illness, and I would expect that. Other than that, all these other guys, I don't see them turning the corner, so they're going to continue. And you make a great point of cluster injuries. For people who watch the game, you can, and, you know, with the injury index, I've said all along that I'm not saying Detroit was the right side. I'm just saying the Eagles were injured. And obviously, Detroit had some players come back with Gerard Davis, a key player, and Decker, their left tackle. But there was a special teams touchdown. And you could say, well, that's a fluke. Without that special teams touchdown, you know, it might have been a different game. But it's not a fluke. It's all related to the cluster injuries you're talking about. Mac Hollins, the backup wide receiver, told Mike Garafolo, look, I like it when I just concentrate on special teams. Look, when Mac Hollins is only playing special teams, he concentrates on special teams. When you have second stringers who are special teamers elevated to starters, whether in the defensive backfield or wide receivers or otherwise, their attention gets diverted from special teams. Their energy is devoted to regular down snaps, and special teams becomes their rest period. So it's not a shock that Agnew was able to return a kick for a touchdown when that happens. And that also has to do with cluster injuries.
Payne, that's kind of the reason you tell me I'm not allowed to focus on anything but football, because you worry I'll be distracted if I have anything else going on in my life during the fall, right?
No question about it. And to Dr. Chow's point, special teams was actually a weakness of the Detroit Lions the first two games. So things flip-flop there. A crucial return touchdown for Agnew, which kind of swung momentum back early in their favor.
Yeah, it gave Detroit a leg up that they would never relinquish in getting a big road victory. You can follow Dr. David Chow on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. Like I said, one of the best follows on game day to give you real-time injury information that can impact some of your decisions for fantasy lineups and otherwise. Dr. Chow, can't thank you enough for your time this morning and look forward to doing it again same time next week.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you.
Well, that at least sounds pain. Like Daniel Jones' rookie campaign is going to be that much more difficult if he doesn't have the services of one Saquon Barkley behind him.
Tough to navigate without Barkley. But he did a good job against the Buccaneers defense. It'll be interesting to see if Wayne Gallman can shoulder a little bit of that load, but certainly it makes Daniel Jones' job much tougher without his most dynamic weapon in the backfield.
That is for sure. And of course, the Giants will face off with the Washington Redskins, a team we'll see on full display this evening in the nation's capital, where the Redskins enter the contest as a 5.5-point home underdog, total on the game 41 as the Bears come a-calling. And Payne, last year, the Bears won one road game by more than 7 points. And it was that debacle against Buffalo that I think all of us have kind of scraped from our memories. And when you look at the Redskins, not exactly a ringing endorsement for how they performed on Monday Night Football. Since 1998, the Skins are a stunning 1-16 at home. And the numbers against the spread, well, those don't get much better. We can go all the way back to 1993, albeit a historical sample size that has absolutely no relevance on tonight, but still fun to discuss. 8-26 straight up, 10-24 against the spread when playing on Monday Night Football. So I guess the first question I have for you is, can Mitchell Trubisky shake some of those demons and feast on this Redskins defense?
You're right. Mark Rippon and Art Monk are not walking through that door tonight, I don't believe.
That is a very good point, and you're not going to have a tenacious Redskins defense living in that Bears backfield. At least I wouldn't be led to believe.
Listen, we kind of saw this coming for Trubisky. Let's be nice. He had a couple big throws on the game-winning drive at Denver. There just needs to be more consistency, right? And there needs to be more production from Trubisky. Defenses right now are squatting on this offense. They're daring Mitch to beat them, and they're daring to beat him deep. And if you look at some of these numbers, you see why. He's completed 6 of his 29 throws that have traveled beyond 10 yards. He's got a 32 passer rating on those same throws. He has been wildly inaccurate. God, that's the nicest way I can put this.
That was very gentle.
28% of Trubisky's 72 pass attempts have graded out as being uncatchable. That's the second highest percentage among qualifying quarterbacks. The positive, I guess, if we're trying to spin it that way for Mitch, you look at the Redskins defense, they have allowed 86% of short and intermediate throws to be completed. And so, you know, that's kind of where he's lived. That's kind of where the Matt Nagy offense lives a little bit. With those short intermediate throws. So hopefully that will build Trubisky's confidence here. The other thing we've seen is the Washington front seven, which many of us thought would be the strength of the team, has been not very good, right? 28% pressure rate through two data points. They're 30th in sack rate. It's been very disappointing for the Redskins defense and Greg Minuski. The front seven, I just thought, was going to be so much better. In addition to not being able to get pressure, right, you're looking at this team that's been bullied around in the trenches a little bit. 60% of runs have graded successful against them. That's dead last in the NFL. It's 11% worse than league average. They've given up 10 explosive runs. Secondary hasn't been much better. Josh Norman, good grief. I mean, come on, man. Redskins secondary has allowed 58% of passes to grade successful. That's second worst. Now, if you're a Washington fan, I think there is some noise a little bit in those numbers, right? You face the Cowboys. They have a fantastic O-line. They have the most efficient offense so far. You face the Eagles offense. I know they're 1-2, but the offense is still good. The O-line still well above average. The Bears offense is likely a step down. So I think that's big. Also looks like Washington's going to have some reinforcements on defense. They get Jonathan Allen back. He fully participated in Saturday's practice. So I think that's a big get back here. I want to see how the Browns attack a little bit. Maybe you get David Montgomery involved a little bit more. The first game, I think he had 7 touches. Second game against Denver had 19. I think that's probably where he needs to live, whether it's catching the ball a little bit more out of the backfield like we saw him do in the Green Bay game. That was a fantastic catch. That was an explosive pass. Get him going in that regard as well. So this is a guy that probably needs to have 15 to 20 touches a game running or catching out of the backfield. I think it's just much smarter to keep him closer to that second game touch rate. Trubisky's been pressured. I don't want to say a significant amount because it hasn't been. It's just 32% of his dropbacks. So it's a normal rate. I think that's an amount you can live with. It's not totally on the O-line. You look at Trubisky himself. He's been credited, I think, with allowing 5 pressures and 3 sacks. So he needs to be better mentally, right? And this is a question mark that we've had about Trubisky as well. Get things set up pre-snap. Be able to identify what's going on pre-snap so you can shift your protections. You can audible to a play that's going to be a little bit more conducive to success, right? Rather than, you know, run yourself into a sack, step up into the pocket and either take off or connect on a throw. These are the issues I think Trubisky's having, and it's not just the inaccuracy when he's throwing, but some of the mental decisions pre-snap as well that he's going to need to get rectified here. Along the offensive line, we want to monitor Kyle Long. I know he traveled with the team. He had limited practice on Wednesday, Thursday, and I believe Friday. Did not practice on Saturday, so that's one to monitor. But I do know he traveled, so that would be a big loss if he's not there at left guard as well.
Definitely hurts. And when you look at this Redskins defense, as you mentioned, hasn't exactly passed its opening two tests with flying colors, surrendering 6.7 yards per play, which is bottom of the barrel, and there aren't a whole lot of other stats to provide a silver lining as far as what kind of resistance this defense can offer up, even against the Bears offense that's much maligned. And if you read some of these Bears comments and quotes, I'm not sure I necessarily buy into it. I may take it with a grain of salt, you know, basically saying that they're extremely close to finally exploding and having that signature game, whether it comes from Mitchell Trubisky himself, Tariq Cohen, or a variety of other players. But when we look on the other side of the ball, Payne, clearly it's strength on strength, relatively speaking. The Bears defense has been as good as advertised coming into the campaign, getting pressure, showing that they haven't really missed a beat. Meanwhile, the Redskins, we know they're extremely one-dimensional. Case Keenum, 600 yards passing so far this season, 5 touchdowns, 69% completion percentage, and a passer rating north of 111. But if you're one-dimensional against the Chicago defense, and they don't have to really respect any threat of a run game with a 97-year-old Adrian Peterson toting the rock, how difficult a task does it make it for the Redskins to consistently sustain drives tonight?
Well, I think you need to have some semblance of balance on offense, right? And this isn't surprising, though. You know, the offensive line for Washington was a question mark coming into the season. They're not creating enough space in the ground game. 29th in adjusted line yards. No push, no lanes. It's been really bad. And you see through two games, Gruden's only called 30 runs. 11 of them have graded successful. It's like 12% on average, below league average. It's clear they miss Trent Williams at left tackle. Donald Penn is filled in there. I mean, he had a much better second game than he did on the road in the Philly opener. But right now, you look, when the Redskins are attempting to run over left tackle, the success rate of those runs is 48% below league average. So it,
that's not very good.
I don't think Case Keenum's the guy that you're going to be able to rely on every single game, chucking it around the park. He's actually been a pleasant surprise, and you're still 0-2, right? So he needs some help here. I think if you can get the ground game going, and we've kind of talked about this, you don't necessarily need an effective ground game to use play action, but it certainly would help. I think it certainly would help Gruden's confidence in calling play action when things are going a little bit better on the ground. Right now, Keenum's only throwing with a play fake element like 19% of the time. He has hit some explosive plays out of play action, but it's not been awesome there either. So I don't know if that's the thing that's going to solve everything, because Keenum's completion percentage is 8% less when using play action. I guess you would want to target, just looking at this early on, again, it's only two data points. Teams have had some success using their tight ends. They've given up 15 receptions on 19 targets the Bears defense has to tight ends. 9 yards per reception on average and a touchdown. Obviously, this would be a great game for Jordan Reed to be in. He's still out, so maybe it's Vernon Davis. He is available. He looks like he's still athletic and fast enough to contribute here, so maybe that's someone you focus on. I think the other thing here is why you want to establish the ground game just a little bit. And I'm not, it's 2019, so you got to be pass first. But try to wear these guys out on defense, right? I know they've had an extra day of rest, but you think about Bears in general on that side of the ball, 85 snaps defensively at altitude in Denver. If you can somehow maybe go a little bit of pace, if you're Washington, get the ground game going, be a little bit more physical with them, it may have some impact late in the game.
Chris Thompson game, baby. Chris Thompson, get him involved.
It's my guy. He's elite, man. Just get him the ball in space. He's very efficient, very effective. I mean, good hands. Really, if you watch the last few years, he's been a vital part of their offense. I wish he was on a little bit better team because he's a dynamic playmaker. But again, it would be smart of Gruden. And I'm not saying he's overly smart, right? Because it's this mental head game battle. Do I want to go tempo and create more plays, which hurts me against a better team, right? Long term, the better team should want more plays. At the same time, again, you look 85 snaps in altitude for that Bears defense. Would it be smart to maybe go a little tempo? That's going to be the battle Gruden has, and I'm really intrigued to see which option he chooses tonight.
One last thing, and it doesn't necessarily pertain to tonight, but I'm always curious to get your philosophical take, because I'm sure it's going to grab national headlines. It popped up a number of times when I did my reading on this. Does Daniel Jones' performance for the Giants, Payne, expedite the Redskins' desire to see what they have in Dwayne Haskins if they were to lose tonight against the Chicago Bears?
Listen, I'm kind of someone that focuses on what I do, not really what anyone else is doing.
Yep.
So if you're making decisions based on that, I think you're probably not the right head coach for this job. That said, there is a need, I would believe, at some point to figure out what you have in Dwayne Haskins, because the quarterback crop coming out this next draft is really good. So you need to find out if Dwayne's competent, if he's capable, if he's your guy moving forward. Now, you know, you spent the first round pick on him, you would think there's going to be some leeway there. The battle that's going on here, though, right? Gruden's fighting for his life right now, right? If you somehow go 4-12 this year, you're likely losing your job. So that's going to be part of this decision-making process. You would think the GM ownership is probably going to have a little say in who's quarterback throughout the course of the year. I've maintained for a long time, though, if you can have signs of potential with Haskins, and we've already seen it from McLaurin at receiver. These are guys now that are under your wing that you could sell as hope moving forward. It'll be an interesting debate, though, because Case Keenum isn't that dude despite the early start or the very good start early on. I want to see what Haskins has. It just be interesting to see how long this goes, because there is potential there next week with Saquon down to pick up a win.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. We'll see how the Redskins perform. A great test for them defensively at home. We talked about some of their futility at Monday Night Football. Whether it's a trend, whether it's cause for concern, we will see it on full display against the Bears offense, intent on getting on track. Special thanks to Dr. David Chow, who joins us every Monday to give us context about the biggest injuries in the game and when we can expect some of the biggest names to be back out there on the field, not only for a wagering perspective, but also on the fantasy side. Payne, put a bow on week three. Got any final parting shots, any words of wisdom before we get out of Dodge?
No, nothing for me on tonight's game. Was a little early, sharp money on the under at 42.5 and 42. I even saw it. Some come in at 41.5. Again, not for me because of how the Washington defense has looked and then the potential idea of Gruden using some tempo. But we do obviously have action on this game, right? If you've been a loyal listener, and most of you are at this point, you listen to the offseason podcast, the NFC preview podcast, where we gave out Washington under 6.5 wins. So we do have a rooting interest tonight that the Bears come out with a victory here.
Definitely the kind of games you don't want to give away when you're sitting on an under ticket. That is for damn sure. And for all the loyal listeners out there, be sure to follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. Follow the podcast at Bet the Board. And you, of course, can follow me there as well. Best of luck with whatever you elect to do for the final game of the week three slate. We'll be right back with you on Thursday to preview the biggest games of NFL week four. And of course, the college football podcast kicks off in earnest on Wednesday with some marquee matchups there. Best of luck tonight, and hopefully we'll see you at the window.